Welcome to Rapid Reviews in Oncology, GI Cancers Edition, a special three-part audio program recorded during the January 2019 Gastrointestinal Cancer Symposium in San Francisco, focusing on the selection and sequencing of systemic therapy for patients with advanced colorectal, gastric, and hepatocellular cancers. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this third issue, focusing on the management of advanced gastric gastroesophageal cancer, I met jointly with Dr. Jaffer Ajani from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas, and Dr. Joseph Chow from the City of Hope Comprehensive Cancer Center in Duarte, California. To begin, Dr. Chow commented on the potential clinical implications of the Phase 3 KEYNOTE-181 trial of pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy in second-line therapy for advanced esophageal cancer, which was presented at this meeting.
So, you know, large Phase 3 study, KEYNOTE-181, definitely met at least one of its primary endpoints in terms of they actually had three primary endpoints for their Phase 3 study comparing second-line pembrolizumab versus standard of care paclitaxel for esophageal, both squamous and adenocarcinomas, specifically in terms of the combined positive score PD-L1 testing for those in which their score was at least 10 or above. They actually did show a significant survival benefit as well as progression-free survival benefit. So this is definitely clinically meaningful. I think many guidelines will be looking at this, and likely there will be regulatory approval shortly coming for this indication.
Jaffer, what was your take on these data and also the issue that came up in terms of the histology, adeno versus squamous?
So I think, you know, we already had some hints that this is likely to be more beneficial for squamous histology. So there have been studies already published with Nevo and Pembro in squamous carcinoma of the esophagus showing higher response rates. Also, the PD-L1 positivity is a little bit higher, especially if you look at the CPS score and also the TPS score, which is just a tumor, scoring tumor for PD-L1 expression. So I think we have to wait for additional data, but it's going to shake out, in my opinion, to be more beneficial for squamous histology than for adenohistology. Because for adenocarcinoma, we already have some data showing that the PD-L1 positivity is lower than for adeno of the stomach, and squamous is higher. So squamous is high, adeno is low, and then gastric is higher. So I think these data are more meaningful for squamous carcinoma. And there is another study, Attraction 3. We don't know a lot of details, but that study is also comparing nivolumab to paclitaxel. And the press release says that the study is positive for survival. And they don't even talk about CPS score there. So I think it may be that in general, that the checkpoint inhibitors will be beneficial for squamous histology, will show some benefit. And when you go up to CPS 10 and above, of course, the benefit is going to increase. So I think this is where we want to go because we know there are subsets in the patients that we see in the clinic, and we don't recognize that. But this is going to give us some idea as to how to separate out the patients who are very likely to benefit, and those who are not likely to benefit.
Joseph, can you talk a little bit about, assuming there is regulatory approval, you could access treatment, what's a situation where you might be thinking about using a checkpoint inhibitor in these kinds of patients?
Right. So I agree with Dr. Ajani in terms of squamous histology, esophageal cancers, metastatic. You know, patients went through first-line therapy, and unfortunately, these patients invariably demonstrate progression. So for those in which we then subsequently do the PD-L1 testing by the combined positive score assay using the 22C3 DACO-approved agent, for those, you know, with that score of at least 10 or above, then I think the data is pretty clear in terms of benefit for these patients over our historical chemotherapy.
Jaffer, can you envision a situation, maybe an elderly patient, where you might want to use a checkpoint inhibitor up front?
Yeah. And in fact, we are asking some of the patients like that where you're a little bit hesitant to give them combination therapy. And they are turning down chemotherapy because, as we all know, that at least the PD-1 inhibitors are much better tolerated than chemotherapy, you know, if you think about combination chemotherapy. So, yes, I think we can envision that.
So I want to move on now and talk a little bit about the issue of sequencing of therapy, particularly getting beyond first-line therapy of metastatic gastroesophageal cancer and the options that come up in clinical practice and how you sort through them. Joseph, in your own mind, how do you think about the sequence of therapy and how it varies based on various clinical factors?
Sure. So I think with the current data that's published, current guideline recommendations for initial diagnosis, we'll start with gastroesophageal adenocarcinoma. Actually, a lot of the phase 3 data is really in that histology. With initial diagnosis, you know, HER2 overexpression definitely plays a major factor in terms of whether or not to incorporate trastuzumab to standard frontline platinum and fluoropyrimidine therapy. Actually, many of us, you know, involved in NCCN do believe the toxicity profile of FOLFOX is very favorable compared to high-dose cisplatin 5-FU. Definitely a move away from triplets that contain epirubicin, given some recent data in the last few years. But then for those patients who subsequently progressed on first-line therapy, paclitaxel ramucirumab currently is the reference regimen based on the RAINBOW study, given survival benefit over single-agent paclitaxel. But then when we get into third line, it certainly, you know, there seems to be more options emerging, of course, from KEYNOTE-59 with the accelerated approval of pembrolizumab for those in which the combined positive score PD-L1 expression is at least one or above. We could use pembrolizumab single agent in that patient population. But then for those in which their PD-L1 is zero, essentially no evidence of expression. I mean, historically, we're still usually left with irinotecan therapy, but now there seems to be emergence with TAS-102, trifluridine, tipiracil, based on the phase 3 TAC study. So that, you know, definitely did show an overall survival benefit in patients who are in third-line therapy and beyond compared to placebo. They met their endpoints in terms of both progression-free and overall survival. They also had an interesting analysis in terms of prevention of deterioration of performance status. You know, these were good performance status patients who were enrolled on the study, ECOG in 0 and 1, so certainly it does present a challenge in which these patients are typically very ill. They may not have that performance status, but at least for those with still good performance status in which may not have a good trial to offer them, certainly TAS-102, I think, could be a consideration for these patients.
Anything you want to add to that or any differences in terms of how you approach the patient with MSS-stable, HER2-negative metastatic disease?
No, I think, you know, the ranking that you outlined, I completely agree with that. So, you know, if HER2 is negative, then you just do a platinum compound and a fluoropyrimidine, and preferred is FOLFOX. Then the second line is very solid. Ram paclitaxel, I think it will be hard to shake that. And there are a lot of strategies being thought around that, how to unseat ram paclitaxel. So that is solid. In the third line, I agree that it would be preferred to go with pembro, at least in US, because we have approval. Because if you think about TAS-102, I personally don't think it's all that very good drug because it has almost no response. And, you know, in third line, although these are selected patients in the trial, but in the clinic, most of these patients are highly symptomatic. And you really need relief of symptoms. And then you think about survival later on, even if you think about survival. At 12 months, it's only 7% improvement at 12 months in the experimental arm. But if you think about pembro, it is double. The one-year survival rate is about 14% for PD-L1 positive patients compared to, you know, the delta is 14%. And you get a tail with checkpoint inhibitors for those who are benefiting. This is irrespective of tumor type. You know, you get all these tails of stability and responding patients that you're not going to get with TAS-102. So I would kind of put it towards the end for selected patients who are not very, very symptomatic, maybe those who have very low volume disease. So I think we have to be careful when we're using that drug in the clinic.
Kind of sounds a little bit like the issue with colorectal cancer, that it's kind of used after everything. It doesn't seem to help that much, but relatively tolerable. There are some data with regorafenib in gastric cancer. Is that an option? Would you ever even do that outside a trial setting?
So at this point, I would not. You know, the data you speak of, it's the INTEGRATE trial. It's at least randomized phase two data. There is an ongoing phase three, and which actually I'm personally not participating in, but certainly it would be of interest to see if that's a positive study. It is compared against placebo. But I think it may, even with that study being positive with the toxicity profile of regorafenib, of course, in colorectal cancer, there's been strategies to look at alternative dosing. To my knowledge, I don't believe the phase three study is looking at the alternative dosing, but certainly if there's not a good clinical trial in which I can offer a patient, you know, they still have at least fair performance status to tolerate such therapy, then possibly, at least after seeing the data, would I consider it.
Focusing a little bit more on second line therapy, Joffrey, can you comment on the KEYNOTE-61 study? It was published in The Lancet. And I think it was actually presented here at ASCO GI a year ago, pembrolizumab versus paclitaxel. What was seen in that study and what you think it means?
So they made a really big mistake and they had asked us to participate and we said no. So first of all, you know, taxanes are good drugs for gastroesophageal cancer. And they decided at that time, you know, several years ago, to go against it. And I think that was a big mistake. I told them that, you know, you should have designed the study like the Attraction 3 that goes with the chemotherapy instead of going against chemotherapy.
So you wanted to see a combination of chemo and checkpoint,
yeah,
like lung cancer.
They would have won if they had combined pembro plus taxane versus taxane instead of pembro against taxane. So the study was negative. But there were a couple of things there.
Well, it was no difference.
Yeah, there was no difference. So there was no survival advantage. But there was a subgroup analysis of CPS, I think more than 10, that there was advantage. So that reminds us of KEYNOTE 181. You know, like there is a subgroup of patients who benefit considerably. But if you want to capture the entire population, then the study should have been pembro plus taxane versus taxane.
What about the issue of anti-angiogenics with checkpoint inhibitors? We've seen data, for example, in lung cancer looking at atezolizumab, chemo, and checkpoint inhibitors. There's a paper here, a phase 1-2 study, looking at ramucirumab and nivolumab. Any thoughts about that strategy? I've been kind of hearing about this idea of anti-angiogenics and checkpoint inhibitors in renal cell cancer. Of course, you see that with TKI, axitinib, and checkpoint inhibitor. What about in this situation? Any thoughts about that?
So yeah, there's both actually some exploratory first-line cohorts utilizing that combination as well as refractory setting. You know, the response rates, I think, are still modest in some ways. Certainly the durability of response, at least the proportion of patients with durability of responses does appear promising. Though I think it is challenging in terms of how to move forward with that. You know, certainly with the first line data, the hope was that potentially you can have like a double biologic first line treatment, chemotherapy, ramucirumab, PD-1 inhibitor. But with the RAINFALL study being negative in terms of trying to improve overall survival for frontline chemotherapy plus ramucirumab, then it doesn't appear that, you know, that would be an adequate space to introduce that strategy. So in terms of second line therapy, well, in many ways, we're actually waiting for PD-1 inhibitor data in the first line, both KEYNOTE-62 and actually for squamous cell histology esophageal cancers, 590 is actually an ongoing phase three study. So I think we'll have to see how that data shakes out. Because if patients are having first-line PD-1 inhibitors in terms of whether or not to continue an immune checkpoint inhibitor, whether or not it's with a VEGF inhibitor, then we'll likely need new data sets to really explore that.
Joffrey, what about the issue of MSI in gastric cancer? How often do you see it in metastatic disease? And what do we know about the optimal strategy for those patients who are MSI high?
So data are very limited. If you look at the localized gastroesophageal cancer for TCGA or the Korean data, the frequency is a little bit higher than metastatic. You know, it varies from like 15% to 20%. And this is also true in many other tumor types, that for localized disease, there is higher MSI high.
Colon?
Yeah, colon, uterus. But when you are in the metastatic setting, it's very rare. It's like 2 to 3%. And in fact, I got a huge practice of gastroesophageal. Come across maybe 3-4 patients and since, you know, we started doing this. But it's a very good biomarker better than any biomarker for immunotherapy that we know. So if the MSI is high, then the likelihood of response with the limited data that we have is close to 50%. And then what happens is that the response duration is much longer than chemotherapy, and also overall survival is so much better than you will ever see with chemotherapy.
Do you think MSI testing should be standard in any patient with metastatic disease?
Yeah, it is now recommended. It's in the NCCN guidelines. And since the approval of Pembro in tumor agnostic setting for MSI high tumor, we are doing it. And in fact, we had a discussion just a few days ago. There are certain groups of physicians with different tumor types, because of very low frequency, they are not doing it routinely. But we probably should be doing it, because it's a, you know, it consumes the tissue, depends on how much tissue you have. So, you know, I want to bring up this NTRK fusion, and that was also approved tumor agnostic. Very high response rate.
You see that with gastric?
Well, yes, we do see occasionally with gastric. It's only 1% in gastric population. But if the MSI is high, then it is like 36% or 38% fusion. So I think this is something good to understand, that if you have MSI high patient and they are responding to checkpoint inhibitor and then having progression, or they are not responding to checkpoint inhibitor, which is like 50%, you should probably do NTRK fusion on them.
Wow, I've never heard of that. There's a high level of NTRK in these
in MSI high patients.
Oh, MSI, no. So MSI anywhere or just gastric?
Anywhere.
Wow, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, so NTRK fusion is much higher when you have DNA damage repair deficiency.
Are there trials combining checkpoint inhibitors and NTRK inhibitors?
Not that I know, but I think it should be probably done. So in other words, every MSI high patient should have NTRK testing done.
That is really fascinating. Going back to this issue of second line therapy, Joseph, in your own mind, you know, you have a patient start out on FOLFOX, maybe they respond a little bit, they progress. As you know, I'm sure a lot of patients, they see, you know, commercials on TV for checking. There's a lot of awareness about checkpoint inhibitors. How do you go through with them, so the risks and benefits of, for example, PAC-RAM versus a checkpoint inhibitor?
So actually, as you know, adding to the MSI data, you know, in KEYNOTE-61, they did look at a small subset that were MSI high, and you know, essentially that's where we have a lot of the 50% response rate data. It does appear like it's being maintained across lines of therapy. KEYNOTE-59 also showed that same data. So actually, in the guidelines, in those patients who have high microsatellite instability, you can consider pembrolizumab in the second line setting. But outside of that, for microsatellite stable disease, given the fact that KEYNOTE-61 didn't meet its primary endpoint, at this point, it's not standard of care to consider a checkpoint inhibitor, at least in second line. But certainly in terms of, you know, advising about toxicities with immune checkpoint inhibitors, I usually try to explain to patients that your immune system is a bit too enthusiastic. Instead of only attacking tumor, if you affect normal organs affecting intestines, I advise them about the diarrhea risk, gastrointestinal toxicities, liver hepatic dysfunction. So, you know, I tell them it's not trivial if these toxicities are severe, but thankfully across the board in terms of the safety signal that we've seen with pembrolizumab and GI cancers, it doesn't appear to be that different than other tumor malignancies, at least, you know, less than 5% in terms of severe grade 3 or 4 toxicities.
Again, getting back to this risk-benefit issue in the second-line setting, Jaffer, the patient asks you, or you want to go through with the patient, potential for benefit, the likelihood they're going to have a response or they're going to benefit from treatment. Globally, how do you compare for them the option, it was outside of label, but the option of a checkpoint inhibitor versus PAC-RAM?
So I think for all comers in second-line setting with PD-L1 positive tumor, MS stable, the checkpoint inhibitors are not very good drugs in second line or third line, because 90% of your patients are going to progress, you know, pretty rapidly. So this is why I think we have to kind of, again, focus on the heterogeneity and, you know, find better biomarkers to identify patients who are going to benefit, like MSI high. I would immediately jump on giving that patient in second line or even first line, you can make an argument. But if the MS is stable, then I think ramp paclitaxel provides a higher response rate, you know, symptom relief, and a higher fraction of patients are likely to benefit. So I will save the checkpoint inhibitor for later on. Compared to, like we said, TAS 102, Pembro is better, but Pembro in general is not a very good drug, neither is Nivo, because a small fraction of patients are benefiting.
Joseph, what about the issue of ramucirumab alone without paclitaxel? There was a trial that looked at that. For example, a patient either with pre-existing neuropathy or a lot of treatment-related neuropathy. Is that an option you consider?
So it certainly has improved activity versus placebo, but the response rates are definitely much more modest when you're not pairing with chemotherapy. I personally have not used it much myself. There actually is at least mainly retrospective data in terms of utilizing a non-neurotoxic chemotherapy regimen, FOLFIRI, with ramucirumab. Though in terms of prospective data, we're actually still waiting for, there is a randomized phase 2 that's ongoing in Europe, the RAM-IRIS trial that's looking at FOLFIRI versus paclitaxel. Hopefully that'll give us some signal that possibly we can pair ramucirumab with, again, a non-neurotoxic chemotherapy regimen. Certainly we have that data in terms of safety for colon cancer, you know, quite a large data set, phase 3 study in colon cancer in which, you know, that regimen is both active and has an acceptable profile. So hopefully we then have an alternative to paclitaxel because of the neuropathy issues.
Jaffer, I have to ask you, because I think I remember talking to you about this in the past. There's a paper here, there have been lots of papers. There's one here at ASCO GI on the impact of antibiotic use in response to checkpoint inhibitors, and gets into the whole microbiome, which we could talk about for hours probably.
Yeah.
But just to cut to the chase, any thoughts about this issue of the microbiome and checkpoint inhibitors and this issue of antibiotics?
So I think this is a new but very hot area. And you remember the science paper from MD Anderson where, may I explain that?
Sure.
So basically what they did was they had more than 100 melanoma patients, and some had responded to checkpoint inhibitors and some did not. They took patients' microbiome, you know, colon microbiome, and then profiled them, and then they found different signatures. And then they took that information to a mouse model where all the microbiome was ablated in mice, and then they introduced human microbiome in mice. And if you change the microbiome to the responding patient's microbiome, the mice also responded. So in other words, there is a set of bacteria. If you have that in your gut, you're going to respond to checkpoint inhibitor. That's the idea. And of course, the complexity of this, you know, is enormous to understand how that happens. So I think there are now data, very interesting data, looking at microbiome and everything else, like hepatitis or colitis. And so in other words, which toxicity you're likely going to get, there's a microbiome signature appears to correlate with that, correlates with the response. So this is a very new area, and it may be that instead of antibiotic, we'll be doing fecal transplant, you know, ahead of time in patients and then giving them immunotherapy, checkpoint inhibitor or whatever else you want to do, like cell therapy or whatnot. But I think this is very, very important because the data in general with microbiome, not just cancer, but in general, seems to be that there is a very high regulation that our, you know, what bacteria you harvest in your entire body, not just the colon, but everywhere else, has related to your germline. And then all this interaction, what makes you and your disease and response to therapy and toxicity and allergy, all that seems to be like a continuum.
Any comments on that? This paper that was presented here at ASCO GI was actually multiple types of cancer, but looking at this issue, saying that there seems to be a correlation between the use of antibiotics and, I guess, lack of benefit.
Yeah, lack of benefit, of course. So there have been some papers before this where they said if your patient gets antibiotic just before they get checkpoint inhibitors, you're reducing the effect of the checkpoint inhibitors. And, you know, this is just a correlative study, but we really need to have in-depth understanding of what is really happening.
Any follow-up comments on that?
Well, I mean, certainly I agree with that. You know, microbiome is a very major area of research. In fact, patients currently enrolled on trials with immune checkpoint inhibitors are actually getting stool samples collected now. You know, patients certainly give us a puzzling look in terms of asking for their proof.
But so you're doing that in your own center?
Yes, we are.
Wow, interesting.
Both investigator-initiated as well as industry-sponsored trials are, you know, this, again, because it's MERGE is such a major issue. But I think there's still a lot of challenges in terms of timing of the stool collection. I mean, you can wake up in the morning, you know, talking to other scientists who've done this work for quite a many number of years, that, you know, your microbiome could vary very much in the afternoon after eating, you know, breakfast and lunch versus what it was in the morning when you first wake up from fasting. One thing I do want to add in terms of, you know, again, looking at responses to immune checkpoint inhibitors in the tumor genomics is, you know, with MSI, there is some emerging data that's very interesting in heterogeneity of microsatellite instability actually within the tumors themselves. There's actually data from a Korean phase 2 study that actually also looked at EBV as being a very positive marker correlating with response to immune checkpoint inhibitors in gastric stage 4 cancer, in which, you know, different areas of the tumor, this is more in the cases that are sporadic in terms of causes of microsatellite instability, in which you may have loss of one of the mismatch repair enzymes in one region of the tumor, but then subsequently still retention in other areas. And this Korean phase 2 study actually had very nice data in terms of looking at, you know, with the subsequent PCR correlation with lack of microsatellite instability in those regions in which they still have retention. And at least for this data set, those patients with that heterogeneity, they actually did not have a durable response to pembrolizumab. So I've personally only seen it myself one time in terms of heterogeneity. You know, the pathologist may comment on it if they at least have a large region of tumor to look at, you know, possibly some regions that have staining, some regions that don't have staining. I think we'll need to collect that data more prospectively to, in order to see if that may be a mechanism of at least primary resistance or even acquired resistance.
That's really interesting. Why don't we go through a few cases? And speaking of MSI, Jaffer, maybe you can talk about your 65-year-old man.
So this is a very interesting situation here. So the gentleman had a lower esophageal moderately differentiated tumor, metastatic, HER2 was negative, and also the PD-L1 was negative by CPS score. But as we discussed before, we do the MSI testing, and we leave it up to our pathologists to select the method. And they're leaning on the four mismatch repair proteins by IHC. And I want to address that issue a little bit later on. But it turned out that he has one of the four protein is not staining. So that means there's a mutation there. So considered MSI high. And so we put him on Pembro, and, you know, he's responding very well right now. He's got symptomatic relief. He's got objective response, and hopefully he'll go on for a long time.
And how long has he been on therapy at this point?
About 5 months.
Any tolerability issues, any autoimmune problems?
Absolutely nothing.
Interesting.
And so there are two things I want to mention. One is that you expect the PD-L1 to be positive in MSI-high patients, you know, because immune system is more alerted, and tumors have the radar detector. They know the immune cell is around, like a T cell. And the way they know is because they can sense the interferon gamma. So T cell will elaborate interferon gamma, and tumor cell can sense that. So then they will express PD-L1. So at least from the current understanding, that's the way it works. Like, tumor is not going to express PD-L1 for nothing because it costs energy, right? It's not efficient. So it will only do it when there is a reason to do it. So in this particular case, PD-L1 is negative, which is kind of surprising.
I never thought about that. In general, are PD-L1 levels high in MSI-high patients?
Yeah, higher than in the MSS patients.
Interesting. Okay. But in spite of that, he responded.
That's right. And the second thing I want to mention is the testing. So you know there are two other proteins. One is ARID1A. It's a tumor suppressor, and there is a mutation for loss of function of ARID1A. And what ARID1A does is an adapter protein for one of the mismatch repair protein to load onto the DNA. So you cannot really load onto DNA unless this adapter is helping you. If this is mutated, one of the four proteins, I think it's MSH6, which collaborates with ARID1A. So you don't have ARID1A, MSH6 can be perfectly normal. There's nothing wrong with the genomic sequence, and there's nothing wrong with the protein, but it cannot function properly because it's not being helped by ARID1A. So if you just test for this, it can be perfect, but still you may have a high TMB. And this was reported by our group in Nature Medicine like last year. The second one is the PALB2. PALB2 is another adapter protein for BRCA1 and 2. So your BRCA1 and 2 can be perfectly normal, but if your PALB2, which is another tumor suppressor, this loss of function, you know, you get high tumor burden, you get cancers because of that germline mutation of PALB2. You get breast cancer, you get pancreatic cancer, you get gastric cancer. Ovarian cancer.
So are you saying that PALB2 tumors respond to checkpoint inhibitors?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. There are some very initial data because they have a high tumor burden also. So if you have loss of PALB2, it's like having BRCA1 or 2 mutation.
Do you see response to checkpoint inhibitors with BRCA1 or 2 mutations?
Yeah. Because it's
more than non-BRCA1 or 2?
That's right. There is some early data because of the TMB is higher. Of course, they are more amenable to PARP inhibitors. But again, the whole idea is, you know, you cannot repair your DNA. That means you're going to have a lot of alterations. You add PARP inhibitor, you get even more alterations. And then checkpoint inhibitors are going to be more effective. So the message I want to give is that we need to start looking at a lot of these adapter proteins that may be abnormal, but you take these heavyweights, you know, like the mismatch repair protein of BRCA1 and 2, they may be completely normal, and yet there may be deficiency in DNA repair.
That's fascinating.
So it depends on what method you use. Hmm. People are really pushing for whole genome sequencing, which produces, you know, millions and millions of data points. You can't really handle that in the clinic. So if you do immunohistochemistry, you're going to miss a lot of other adapter proteins. You do PCR, you're just looking at the microsatellite instability because PCR, so you have the mismatch repair proteins, and then you got the damage. So PCR looks at the damage, and immunohistochemistry looks at the integrity of your repair machinery. So those are two different things. And how you assess this is an ongoing debate. So our pathologists, as I mentioned, they just want to look at the repair machinery rather than damage. That damage will be the microsatellite instability. And like Joseph mentioned, and you also mentioned, that there's immense heterogeneity in MSI high patients. So for example, the most frequent tumor is the uterine cancer, 30%, but then the amount of damage is very low compared to colon cancer is way up there, then the gastric and small bowel, and then, you know, others, uterine will be here. So there is data to show that the degree of damage without checkpoint inhibitor has an effect on survival. And what is missing right now is whether the degree of damage, like MSI high colon, has a higher response or not. This we don't know for sure.
Any comments? I know when I'm going to talk to him, it's going to be like, we're going to leave the world for a while and come back. But anyhow.
No, I mean, it's all great data. I mean, certainly, you know, there is that proportion of metastatic gastric cancers that have defects in DNA repair machinery. I'm certainly always looking for those when at least doing targeted sequencing, panel sequencing for my patients. And, you know, I guess I'll add there are ongoing trials looking at PARP inhibitors with PD-1 inhibitors. At least there's still data waiting on safety, but certainly I think expansion cohorts looking at gastric cancers or other cancers with both paired DNA repair defects and possibly, you know, augmenting immune checkpoint inhibitors would be of, you know, major interest as a future direction.
So let's move back, though, to the more common MS stable situation. And Joseph, maybe we can get into your 63-year-old man. What happened there with him?
Sure. So this is a 63-year-old gentleman in January 2016, so preceding a lot of the readouts for the current indications and checkpoint inhibitors. He had epigastric pain, GI bleeding symptoms. Subsequent endoscopy did show a large fungating mass in the gastric body, which confirmed moderate to poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma, HER2 non-overexpressing, immunohistochemistry was only 1+ by the scoring criteria. Unfortunately, had metastatic disease at presentation, peritoneal metastases, cytology confirmed malignant ascites, you know, went through standard of care therapy, first-line FOLFOX.
How did he do? What was his status before when you started the FOLFOX? Was he symptomatic?
Quite symptomatic in terms of his ascites. Actually, our surgeon who initially saw the patient, and actually because of how often he needed therapeutic paracenteses, he actually had a catheter placed in order to have the ascites removed at home. And thankfully, he actually responded quite well to FOLFOX initially. The ascites dried up. He actually was able to undergo removal of the catheter. But unfortunately, with this patient, actually, even before we would have scans demonstrating progression, usually it's recurrence of ascites, more bloating symptoms, which we knew that he subsequently needed switch in therapy. And subsequently, he did have to go on to second-line treatment in January 2017, so a year at this point. And we utilized paclitaxel ramucirumab as standard of care second-line therapy. But then, you know, typical in many ways in terms of the median progression-free survival or time to progression with second-line therapy, he progressed in June of 2017.
Did he actually respond to the paclitaxel?
He actually did. So again, the ascites went away again.
Really?
And certainly there's a lot of at least hypotheses about VEGF inhibitors allowing for a decrease in vascular leakage.
That's interesting. You hear about that with Bev, but I guess ramucirumab as well and other aflibercept. I don't know how to think about that.
Yeah, certainly many of us consider it for that strategy.
Any tolerability issue with the paclitaxel ramucirumab?
No, thankfully neuropathy was minimal. We monitored the hypertension and proteinuria fairly regularly, did not really progress beyond grade 1 if at any point in terms of those toxicities. And I mean, at least for myself, when I utilize first-line platinum-containing therapy, I'm actually pretty proactive. After 4 months of treatment, patients who have response actually dropping out the platinum, even though there's not as much data for maintenance flow permitting in gastric as opposed to colon cancer, I think many of us utilize that strategy in the academic setting and find it to be effective and, you know, also maintain quality of life and then subsequently allow for us to still utilize agents that have neurotoxicity in later lines of therapy.
So what happened next?
Yeah, so subsequently this is now May, June of 2017. We're still a bit a ways away in terms of, actually, this was still prior to the KEYNOTE-59 data being presented. It was like later that month. But actually, we did have a clinical trial open utilizing immunotherapy combinations. And he actually was started on nivolumab and ipilimumab, so dual PD-1 and CTLA-4 inhibitor therapy. Actually initially did well with it. So with this trial, it actually had the same dosing as CheckMate 32 in terms of, you know, relatively lower dose nivolumab, higher dose ipilimumab, given every 3 weeks for 4 infusions before going on to single agent nivolumab. And actually same as with first line therapy and second line therapy, you know, his ascites recurred when he went on the trial. We actually had to put in another abdominal pleurex catheter to allow for drainage, but then subsequently his ascites went away again. And actually, he also at that time developed a palpable abdominal wall mass, and actually it was quite impressive that the abdominal wall mass actually also responded to dual immune checkpoint therapy.
So abdominal wall mass, how often do you see that? Was that related to an invasive procedure or something?
So unfortunately, you know, because of the
peritoneal thing?
We unfortunately can see seeding of the abdominal wall, both, you know, from diagnostic procedures, you know, surgical interventions, and as in spite of our best intentions, you know, in terms of relieving ascites, I think most likely with removal of the catheter, actually he had the catheter removed in earlier lines of treatment because of how well he responded, I think most likely there was seeding of the abdominal wall where the catheter was previously placed.
Just curious, Jaffer, have you seen that, seeding from biopsies or catheters?
All the time.
Really, all the time?
Mm. Oh. Especially if there is known peritoneal disease.
Oh, more then, with peritoneal disease.
So that will track. But spontaneously, it's rare.
How about from biopsies or surgical procedures?
Only if they have peritoneal disease.
Interesting. Yeah. So is the idea that it's a combination of the peritoneal disease but also the catheter? That's where it's happening, where the catheter
That's
is?
Right.
Wow, interesting.
Basically tracking.
So he actually has a response then in this abdominal wall mass.
Yep.
What happened next?
Yeah, so then we were very encouraged with the response, but unfortunately, It wasn't a GI toxicity, which was really my main concern being on dual immune checkpoint therapy. He actually developed a skin rash initially. It was very limited, just some erythema, but very pruritic. And we advised him to start topical steroids, non-systemic steroids, as well as oral hydroxyzine to manage the pruritus symptoms. But unfortunately, the skin rash continued to progress. It actually involved a greater amount of his skin surface, body surface area, actually really became very hyperpigmented, almost, kind of reminded me of my fellowship day seeing GVHD. It was very thickened.
Wow.
So unfortunately, it was still considered grade 2, but it definitely interfered with his quality of life significantly. And actually, we followed the protocol guidelines in terms of starting systemic high-dose steroids at that point. And we actually essentially dosed him at 1 mg per kilogram of prednisone. And thankfully, he actually started responding to the steroids. The skin rash eventually went from grade 2 to grade 1 over about a two-week period. And then we actually were hoping to get him back on immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy on the protocol. So then subsequently started tapering down the steroids. And then once he hit that level of 5 milligrams per day or less of prednisone, we were able to reinitiate the subsequent fourth dose. We actually had to delay the fourth dose of nivolumab and ipilimumab in order to allow for a relief of the autoimmune toxicity. But unfortunately, he did eventually develop progression despite resuming immune checkpoint dual therapy.
So kind of curious about the issue of dermatologic toxicity, Joffrey. When other cancers, when we talk about checkpoint inhibitors, people always are focusing on pneumonitis, colitis, life-threatening issues. But when you really talk to docs in practice, it seems like there are a lot of people with the dermatologic problems.
Yeah, I think it's a very common. There are two most common. One is the thyroid.
Right.
And second one is skin, more often than internal organs. So I had a patient who had, Stevens Johnson's.
Wow.
And he survived that. So fortunately, he survived, but he was on the combination
doublet as well.
Wow. With high EP dose, 3 milligram, and regular dose, Nevo.
Just out of curiosity, did he respond? And do you think there's a correlation between autoimmune toxicity and response?
So this is something I don't know for sure. He responded, but in general, whether those who have some sort of toxicity, immune-mediated toxicity, and whether their survival is better, whether they have a higher response rate, is not clear. I think we should be able to get that kind of data very soon.
So let's move on, and we'll finish out actually talking about HER2-positive disease. And Joffrey, you have this patient. If you could talk a little bit about what happened.
So he's in his late 50s, and he presented with widely metastatic PET avid disease.
Where was the primary?
Primary is at the GE junction. But there are two points I wanted to make. I think one of them was your point. But what happened was he came from another state to us and already had HER2 testing done, but we couldn't get the results. We just couldn't get hold of the doctor, and the office didn't have the results. So we did our own, and it came back 3+. Then once we got that, the doctor calls me, and he said, I already did it, it was negative.
Hmm.
So this is a point I want to make, is that the HER2 expression in gastric cancer compared to breast cancer is quite different. Breast usually has more diffuse. So if you've got a tissue, small breast tissue, the HER2, if you take a sample here or a sample there, you're more likely to find HER2 positivity if it's a HER2 positive tumor. In gastric cancer, if you take a sample here, it can be positive, sample here can be negative.
So this was a biopsy of the primary?
Yeah, both of them were primary.
But they were done at different times, or you got the tissue, the same tissue they looked at?
Well, no, they took their sample and we did another biopsy.
So you did another biopsy and yours was positive. And do you think the other one was a false negative, or you think it really was negative, it was a heterogeneity thing?
It was probably negative, it was just heterogeneity.
Wow.
So, that issue is totally unresolved with the ASCO and CAP guidelines. It was hotly debated whether we should do multiple biopsies or not. And if you do multiple biopsies, do you want to test all of them? And then the pathologists were resisting, saying, we're not going to stain 6 slides from 6 samples and report to you, and there can be confusion and extra work. And so that kind of brings us into liquid biopsy area also. So that's one point. So he had a dramatic response to FOLFOX-expressed trastuzumab that lasted for almost a year, and then he had progression. So we started on ramucirumab, and he had another dramatic response.
Objective response.
Objective response.
Can you just focus a little bit on when he did progress on the first-line therapy, how you thought through options? Because one of the other options that would, and we ask this as a poll, because this is a classic case that we ask all the time, mm-hmm. a lot of people want to keep the trastuzumab going, change the chemotherapy rather than giving PAC-RAM. You gave the patient PAC-RAM and the patient did really well. But what about that other option, keeping the trastuzumab going? Actually, there was a paper here at ASCO GI looking at that. It looks like they didn't find any benefit.
There is no benefit. So we actually published before on maintaining trastuzumab, not beyond progression, but when the patients don't have progression, they have a response, they have stability. I have a patient who is on for 14 years right now on trastuzumab. This is before the TOGA trial that we were doing this. So there have several patients, including one who was on trastuzumab for almost 9 years. So that's a different scenario, but if you have progression, trastuzumab does not work. And this is, you know, if you look at the T-DM1 trial, where a patient had first-line trastuzumab with chemotherapy, HER2-positive tumor, then they were retested, HER2-positive tumor, and were randomized to T-DM1 versus taxane, and that was negative. And there are a bunch of other trials that are negative like that. So I think other thing I want to mention, this is a phenomenon that we don't understand, is that the tumors continue to express HER2 protein. Even if you give trastuzumab and tumor is clearly resistant, there is clear progression. And then you biopsy that and it is highly expressing HER2 protein. So I don't understand that, but this is also in breast literature. And, you know, we will probably, hopefully, be able to discuss some of the new HER2-targeted drugs. Again, this is in patients who are heavily treated, especially breast population, heavily, heavily treated with pertuzumab, T-DM1, trastuzumab, still got HER2-positive tumor. Then they get this new antibody, and they have a dramatic response. So why is this happening is totally unclear.
What about, Joseph, this issue of second-line therapy? Again, we ask this all the time in our meetings. Patient responds to FOLFOX trastuzumab, then comes to the second line, again, looking at this issue of trastuzumab continuing versus paclitaxel-ram. Do you usually do what was done to this patient to go with the paclitaxel-ram? And what about if the patient had, I mean, maybe not 9 years, but a longer response, let's say 2 years?
That's a great question. I mean, these are all, you know, we actually are getting more emerging data to try and address this. So in terms of second-line trastuzumab, yes, there's retrospective data that appears like it's beneficial. So because of the breast cancer data, there's been a lot of application of that strategy in the metastatic gastric cancer. Though, you know, getting to this issue in terms of the heterogeneity of HER2 overexpression, I think there is that big difference between breast and gastroesophageal cancer. So actually, it was ASCO last year in which there was I was very familiar with the abstract because I led the poster discussion for it. Finally, there was a Japanese randomized phase 2 study that actually prospectively studied looking at, you know, for patients who had initial platinum, fluoropyrimidine, trastuzumab, then going on to, they were actually randomized to paclitaxel with continuation of trastuzumab versus just paclitaxel alone. So really prospectively testing that strategy, you know, in many ways trying to replicate the randomized breast cancer data. You know, it was only a 90-patient trial, but at least in terms of their statistics looking at progression-free survival endpoint, it was adequate. And actually what's funny, you know, not often do I look in depth at the breast cancer literature, but actually that turned out to be about the same number of patients that showed that trastuzumab beyond progression was effective in breast cancer. So in this study, you actually don't see any benefit with continuing trastuzumab beyond progression. But really what's most striking is that they were able to sample, unfortunately, only a small percentage, about 16 of their 90 patients, They actually, of course, had confirmation they were HER2 overexpressing at initial diagnosis, so they went on to first-line trastuzumab. But then before they went on to this second-line study, they had rebiopsies for these 16 patients. And actually, it was quite remarkable that about two-thirds of those patients had loss of HER2. So,
wow, interesting.
So you do have cases in which there's loss of HER2, certainly, but you also have cases in which there's, you know, still retention of HER2, as Dr. Johnny has mentioned. But then going back to phase two studies being done in Korea, this was actually a phase two trial led by Dr. Ji-Yoon Lee, in which they actually, you know, getting into circulating tumor DNA, potentially being a promising way to track both spatial and temporal heterogeneity, you actually do see for those cases in which there's retention of HER2 overexpression, there may be other co-drivers that are substantially enriched, such as MET or FGFR2 or cyclin E1. So this certainly, we're now recognizing more and more that there's quite a variability in terms of how resistance develops. There's both loss of HER2 expression, in which I would definitely argue that there's not much benefit in giving a HER2 target agent in that setting. But then at least for those subset of patients in which there's still retention of HER2, then we could potentially explore still using HER2-directed strategies. But then we need to overcome the subsequent co-driver mutations that are arising. So at this point, I would not recommend utilizing trastuzumab beyond progression outside of a clinical trial. But as Dr. Johnny mentioned, there are new HER2-directed agents, which appear promising, which I think we should put those patients on those studies to really continue to look if HER2-targeted strategies can be effective.
Jaffer, another thing, and we saw this last night at the meeting we had here, when you present a patient who's progressing on trastuzumab and chemotherapy, that you see a fraction of people talking about is PAC, RAM, and trastuzumab. Any thoughts about that?
So that is, you know, again, trastuzumab beyond progression. So right now, I think the at least the upper GI community believes that once the patient has progression, HER2-positive patient has progression, then they are mixed with the rest of them. You don't focus on HER2 anymore because there's really no good data to support HER2-targeted therapy, except a couple of molecules out there that are in like emerging from phase one and expansion cohort trials, which they're really very, very promising other molecule. So in other words, I wouldn't continue trastuzumab.
So let's hear about your 74-year-old man, Joseph.
Yeah, so this 74-year-old gentleman in April 2015, really his only presenting, well, I guess abnormal finding was liver function testing being abnormal. His primary care physician subsequently was very proactive in terms of doing further investigation. Actually had a CT scan, which unfortunately demonstrated multiple liver lesions, quite enlarged. Large was about 8 centimeters in the left lobe of the liver, but he also had some gastrohepatic enlarged lymph nodes as well. So an EGD was performed, in which actually there were findings of Barrett's esophagus starting pretty high up in the esophagus at 24 centimeters from the incisors. But then further down, it was a GE junction tumor, actually a CWRT1 being fairly high up in the GE junction from 34 to 39 centimeters. The biopsy did show adenocarcinoma. He actually was found to be HER2 overexpressing. You know, the IHC scoring was 3+, so pretty strong signal for the HER2 biomarker being present. Started him on first line, at least my typical first line treatment, again, being FOLFOX, but then also trastuzumab. He actually was then on maintenance therapy with trastuzumab. Actually did very well with maintenance therapy, quite a prolonged period from about 8 months, November through July of 2016. But then at that point, he subsequently had a progression with regrowth of liver lesions. Previously had a very good response, you know, normalization of his liver function testing.
What happened next?
Yeah, so we, of course, talked about standard of care paclitaxel ramucirumab, a second-line therapy. Again, I usually do not utilize trastuzumab beyond progression, but we actually had a clinical trial that was actually examining differing doses of ramucirumab, essentially high-dose ramucirumab versus standard-dosing ramucirumab. This was open-label, so actually we knew he went on to the high-dose ramucirumab arm with paclitaxel. Thankfully, for the most part, tolerated therapy. You know, he did have some neutropenia, which we already know from the RAINBOW trial. That is not an uncommon toxicity with the taxane plus VEGF inhibitory combination. So with some dose delays. But then what was really interesting too is actually he developed some hypertension, so definitely VEGF mediated toxicity. But then he was really complaining about a lot of scalp bleeding, a lot of scalp symptoms. And I was really puzzled by that. You know, I thought, okay, maybe the taxane leading to alopecia has some issues. But then really when I looked at his scalp, he actually had a small hemangioma that apparently was bleeding at times from, I would only presume, from the VEGF inhibitor therapy leading to abnormal vascularization. So actually, you know, usually with dose delays, thankfully that symptom did not progress any further. So I'm definitely more mindful of these kind of symptoms now for patients on VEGF inhibitors.
That's really interesting. Have you ever seen that?
Yep.
You've seen everything.
We just cauterize them.
No,
if it's like a limited area,
that's
you see that with time. Bev and other anti-angiogenics? Or just ramucirumab?
Ramucirumab is the one that comes to mind.
Huh. So these are hemangiomas that somehow the ramucirumab exacerbates?
Yeah, something triggers the neo-anti-angiogenesis,
wow.
And then ramucirumab will excite bleeding in there.
So I actually never heard about this idea of changing the ramucirumab dose. At this point, what's known about it?
So yeah, that you know, at least actually in many ways the prompting for this trial and then actually for the first line Rainfall trial was, you know, at least from Rainbow and I believe Regard as well, there was a post hoc analysis, this essentially, I guess, drug level response relationship. I mean, of course, with both Rainbow and Regard, patients all had the same dose of ramucirumab. But what's interesting, there appeared to be these quartiles of patients, you know, those in which I guess they processed the antibody much more slowly, had higher ramucirumab levels, they actually had better survival versus those in which, for some reason or another, because of pharmacogenomics, processed the ramucirumab to lower levels. So actually for Rainfall, there was a push up in the dose. You know, it was a day 1-8 dosing as opposed to day 1-15 every 28 days that was utilized in Rainbow. But despite that strategy to try and increase the dose of ramucirumab, there was a progression-free survival benefit, but unfortunately the overall survival benefit still didn't pan out in first line.
Really interesting. So just a couple final closing questions I have. Again, in terms of looking at this meeting, Jaffer, anything else that's being presented or you've heard about that has you excited?
No, not really. I think...
Joseph, anything that you've seen? Anything else at this meeting you want to comment?
I know it's only phase 2 data at this point, but you know another major oral presentation was Yelena Janjigian's data set in terms of combination chemotherapy with trastuzumab and pembrolizumab in the frontline setting, you know, to in many ways try and augment the ADCC activity of trastuzumab. So, of course, phase 2, so we still have to take caution in terms of not necessarily considering that practice changing, but certainly very compelling in terms of the proportion of patients who had responses, the depth of responses, and at least in terms of their survival outcomes with this early look, the median survival wasn't reached yet. But at least the signal was definitely strong enough that there is a current phase 3 that's ongoing, the KEYNOTE-811 trial that's actually randomizing patients to, in addition to pembrolizumab, to frontline chemotherapy and trastuzumab, again, in HER2 overexpressing patients. So hopefully, maybe even for low PD-L1 expression in HER2, there may be augmenting of immuno-oncology approaches with the strategy.
Final question to both of you. First, Jaffer, any myths or misperceptions about the management of gastroesophageal cancer? You see second opinions of people coming in. We talked about MSI testing, but beyond that, anything that you see globally in gastroesophageal cancer people doing in practice that maybe is not optimal?
A lot. Unfortunately, like we mentioned earlier, the community oncologists are overwhelmed. I have fellows in practice who are saying they cannot even handle lung literature right now. There are so many drugs, so many biomarkers. And then the next patient is breast cancer, another one is colon cancer. So when I see their patient with gastric cancer that's already has received one line, it's often something that is not recommended.
Like what?
Like they will use a taxane in the front line, or they use carbopaclitaxel in the front line. And even the penetration of paclitaxel ramucirumab is close to 30%. You won't believe it because the combination has been approved for several years now. And the private practitioners just cannot keep up with the wealth of data that's out there.
Any comments again on specific things that you see people doing that maybe could be done better?
No, I would agree that, of course, FLOT generated a lot of interest for perioperative treatment. But I think both Dr. Johnny and I agree that, you know, it is still for select fit patients because of the toxicity profile. But then I have noticed a lot more incorporation of FLOT in the metastatic setting as well, you know, getting again back to this issue of frontline triplet with taxane.
FLOT in the first-line metastatic setting. Has that been looked at in research?
Phase two data.
Phase two data.
But,
wow. But it's not sufficient to make it like a standard of care.
Interesting.
But people are just looking at the FLOT in the adjuvant, neoadjuvant data, and then they're using it for metastatic patients that they were not doing before. Now they are doing
it. Wow. Any other observations?
So, I mean, I think, you know, there's actually Dr. Johnny has done a lot of this research, I mean, in terms of getting into earlier stage setting. And of course, there are trials incorporating immune checkpoint inhibitors in the earlier stage setting, you know, both in Asia with Attraction 5 study and actually in the US, Keynote 585 is actually looking at perioperative therapy, adding pembrolizumab. But in terms of molecular classification, I mean, hopefully we can finally look at molecular classification as distinguishing prognosis for these patients. There actually is at least post-hoc analyses, so hypothesis generating that MSI actually could be a favorable prognostic factor in early stage gastric cancer, as we already know from stage 2 colon cancer. So possibly can we consider not doing chemotherapy for these patients? I mean, again, still a research question, which I think we need more data, but certainly very compelling in which, you know, we're changing usually what's considered a very negative outlook for these patients.
Fascinating. Final thoughts?
So along the same line, I think, you know, the whole panel of DDR deficient machinery, I think in addition to MSI high and BRCA, we need to look at all these other genes. There are like 27 genes, at least 27, but there are probably 900 of them. So we need to really select out patients who are likely to benefit with like a PARP inhibition, PD-L1 inhibition, or PD-1, or immunotherapy of some sort, segregating the subgroups that are likely to benefit.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Rapid Reviews in Oncology, Gastroesophageal Cancer Edition.